This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
I'm your host, Paige, and you're listening to Reverie True Crime. Before we get into this case, I think it's important to state what Satanism actually is and how some people use this term and make their own twisted version that's not actually what most people consider Satanism. As we know, most people do not do ritualistic killings. It does happen, but that's not what most people who say they are Satanists do. So, we kind of need to clear that up. It's not fair to judge what someone believes based on how some people take it in another direction that isn't what it's supposed to be about. Sourcing from Britannica.com, Satanic movements, including the U.S.-based Church of Satan, founded in 1966, celebrate Satan not as a god, but as a symbol of supposedly anti-Christian moral values or as a pre-Christian life principle. Such movements may be atheistic, agnostic, or deistic. They do not promote or practice evil in any literal sense, but may profess extreme forms of individualism and ethical egoism. And they may reject traditional Abrahamic religions, particularly Christianity, as hypocritical and repressive. There are different types of Satanism, and some people do take it to the extreme, but not all. So I don't think it would be fair to label everyone that says they are Satanist, because that could just mean they're individualist or don't believe in God. However, anyone that takes it to this extreme is totally wrong, of course. I'm definitely not defending that at all. So now that that is made clear, let's talk about Ricky Caso. Ricky was born in March of 1967 in Northport, Long Island. His dad taught history and he was a football coach at a wealthy high school called Harbor High School. He even earned the Nassau County Long Island Football Coach of the Year, which was granted to him by Newsday. Ricky was the older brother of three younger sisters. Some say he was called the, quote, black sheep of a Norman Rockwell family. He even would tell his mom that death would be the ultimate high. On the other hand, his dad said that he was the, quote, model child and young athlete. That's before he started divulging in drugs. When Ricky was a teenager, he had a wild streak. He ran away and started living on the streets, slumbering in the parks, cars, his friends' garages, houses, and basically wandering Long Island. This is when he started taking drugs frequently. Yes, he smoked pot, but he was also taking LSD, PCP, and peyote. It seems he enjoyed that hallucinogenic experience the most. Not only was he indulging in all of these drugs, but he also sold them as well. He usually sold drugs in Northport. Ricky dipped his toes in the waters of the occult and Satanism. There was a cult at Northport High School that was loosely structured, which he was a member of. It was called the Knights of the Black Circle. It was said that the Knights of the Black Circle would burn cats alive and sell drugs, which people claim Ricky did those things by himself without the help of the Knights of the Black Circle anyway. They would have their own satanic rituals, and reportedly they honored Walpurgisnacht, which is the eve of May the 1st, where witches are believed to have organized get-togethers at an arranged location. It's also known as Walpurgis Night. They were said to have commemorated this nighttime affair at the Amityville House in 1984. Ricky also liked to delve into the Satanic Bible. During his junior year of high school, he named himself the Acid King. He was getting in tons of trouble for looting and selling drugs. Ricky's mom and dad did admit him to the South Oaks Psychiatric Hospital at one point. His parents wanted him to get help with his psychiatric issues and drug use. They really wanted to see him rehabilitated. Before it was South Oaks Psychiatric Hospital, it was called the Amityville Asylum, which is located in Amityville, New York. In April of 1984, Ricky was apprehended for robbing a grave back in the fall of 1983. He had taken off with the skull of a person and he stole other items from the cemetery. After he was arrested for robbing the 19th century grave in May of 1984, he contracted pneumonia and he was taken to the Long Island Jewish Hospital to be treated for it. While he was in the hospital for pneumonia, his mom and dad were trying to talk to the doctors about committing Ricky for involuntary psychiatric treatment. They told the doctors that he robbed a grave, took hallucinogens every day, his dark jokes, his suicide attempts, and how he would threaten others. The psychiatrist evaluated him while he was in the hospital and said that he had antisocial tendencies, but that he wasn't psychotic or a danger to society. As soon as he got well from pneumonia, they let him vacate the hospital. Gary Lowers was a good friend of Ricky's. He was 17 years old and he was from Northport. He would often run away from home as well, and he had already dropped out of high school. He was also said to have watched Ricky rob the grave in 1983. The other guys that Ricky was buddies with were 18-year-old Jimmy Troiano and Albert Quinones. They were all basically of the same background as far as not going to school, running away from home, and not having jobs. The boys ran the streets together. Gary was with Ricky at a party one night, and Ricky passed out. During this time, Gary decided to steal 10 bags of angel dust from Ricky's jacket. Of course, when Ricky came to, he went to Gary about it. So Gary told Ricky that he'd give him $50 for the 5 bags that he used, and the other 5 bags he handed back over to Ricky. Well, Ricky never saw the money, and he beat Gary up 4 different times. On a June night, the 16th to be exact, of 1984, Ricky told Gary to come along with him, Albert, and Jimmy. He was ready to let the whole situation go and told him that they could be cool again. That evening, they started with peyote and decided they wanted to go for a walk in the Aztakia woods and make a bonfire. They used Gary's socks and his denim jacket sleeves to light the fire because the wood they had was damp. They were all high, and Ricky said they should use some of Gary's hair to put in the fire. It started as a back and forth of words, and then the fight got physical. Ricky took a bite out of Gary's neck and then pierced him in the chest with a knife. Ricky would not stop beating on Gary for hours. By Albert's account of what happened, Jimmy held Gary down while Ricky was assaulting him. Albert had received immunity and then changed his story, saying he was the one that actually held Gary down, and when he tried escaping, he tackled Gary and dragged him back to Ricky. Gary was stabbed at least 17 times, possibly up to 36. He suffered burns and his eyes had been ripped out. He was severely mangled and mutilated. Ricky had bent Gary's body over and started chanting something about Satan. When he thought he saw Gary's head move, he started repeatedly stabbing him in the face. Allegedly, Ricky and Jimmy were the ones who lugged his body just a short distance away. To hide the body, they threw a bunch of leaves and sticks on top of him. Reportedly, Ricky was yelling at Gary to, quote, "say you love Satan." But Gary responded with, "I love my mother." After this horrific slaying, he boasted about it to a lot of people, also saying that Gary was a human sacrifice. Ricky would also go on to tell people that a black crow sent him a message from Satan, which instructed him to kill Gary. During these weeks that Gary's body was basically turning into a skeleton, Ricky had told over 15 kids his age about what happened, and who knows how many people he actually took to the site to view the horrific scene. He told his peers that if they didn't believe what he said, he would take them to the woods and let them view what was left of Gary's body. None of these teenagers alerted the police or told their parents. July 1st, a teenage girl overheard some other teenagers talking about all of this, and she took it upon herself to call the police about the murder. On July 4th, the cops finally took it seriously, because they thought it was a prank call at first, and they went with the cadaver dogs that discovered Gary's body that was maimed and decomposing. They also found that his corpse was still wearing a denim vest, running pants, white underwear, and a pair of Nikes. The bugs and worms had eaten a lot of Gary's skin, which left a lot of bones visible, and this is why they couldn't quite determine the number of stab wounds. It's also reported that there wasn't really any skin left on his face. Ricky and Jimmy went to a party one night, got high, and went to this lemon of a car that they had bought for $50, and they went to sleep inside of it. Someone called the police station the next morning, reporting a vehicle that looked suspicious. One police officer gets to the scene, and when he realizes who these two sleeping kids are, he calls for backup, because he's not sure what they could do, especially if they were high. So around 18 cops, some in plain clothes, some in uniform, surround the car with their weapons drawn. Ricky and Jimmy were arrested on the 5th of July, 1984. Ricky was wearing an AC/DC shirt at the time of his arrest, and that alone dumped lighter fluid all over the fire of the satanic panic phenomena that a lot of people believed heavy metal music and worshiping Satan were connected. During the whole satanic panic hysteria, Ozzy Osbourne said, quote, "When we came out of seeing The Exorcist, we had to all stay in one room together. That's how black magic we were," end quote. 2 days after his arrest, Ricky completed suicide in his jail cell by hanging himself with a bedsheet. Supposedly, other inmates were chanting for him to hang himself, and he did, which left Jimmy and Albert to tell their side of the story. Jimmy gave a confession that he would recant later and pled not guilty, so he had to wait for his trial to start. He was charged with second-degree murder. Albert said that he saw Jimmy assisting Ricky in the killing. However, his story would change a lot, because another time he said Jimmy absolutely did not help Ricky at all, saying they were both standing there pretty stunned at what they were seeing. With the group being on LSD and other drugs at the time of the murder, none of Albert's witness testimonies could be believed. His testimony was brought into question, and Jimmy was acquitted of his second-degree murder charge by a jury in April of 1985. Albert was never charged with anything that I could find. In November of 1984, Rolling Stone magazine talked to a few people who knew Ricky, Gary, Jimmy, and Albert. So I'm going to read to you this old article of what people had to say. Mike McGrory, a 21-year-old guy that also ran the streets, said Ricky always had that spaced out look about him. He used to run his mouth about being satanic, like he is the devil. When he was high, he'd always sit there and laugh at you, like he was trying to pretend to be crazy. Another boy said, "He told me the way he got out of South Oaks Hospital. He bullshitted. When he went in, they believed he worshipped Satan and shit. And he told the doctors that he was fine, that he was gonna go back to school and doesn't believe in Satan anymore. And he bullshit the doctors so much they finally believed him and they let him go." A 17-year-old girl stated his parents put him in some kind of hospital and he ran away from it. "One day at the train station, I saw him. He dyed his hair so no one could find him. I said, "What's going on?" And he goes, "No way are they going to look me up. I'm not crazy." I was like, "I never said you were crazy, but maybe you need help with drugs." He said, "I do not," and then started yelling, coming closer. I talked my way out of it. I think Ricky stopped living in 8th grade. Mark Fisher, 17 years old, said, "I've known Ricky since 6th grade. First time he tripped, in 7th grade, in art class, he had drawn a dragon on the board and said it started to move. First time Ricky got in trouble was 8th grade. He stole a container of high C from the church. Kinda ironic that he ends up worshiping Satan and starts stealing from the church." Tony Zinkus, 19 years old, said, "There's a power trip in Satanism. It says, now you can strike back at the people that screwed you up. The doctor said queso was antisocial. Wrong. Antisocial means sitting in a corner at a party. Sociopathic means robbing graves." One teenager said, "Ricky took everything, just like Jim Morrison. The younger crowd was impressed by what he did. About 6 months ago, he started going to the South Bronx with a friend of mine. He used to drive in, get dusted, and drive back. After 2 months, they finally crashed my friend's car. They were all dusted out. Rick found other ways to get into the city. I told Ricky, 'Do too many drugs, you'll be dead soon.' He said, 'Yeah, that's exactly what I want.' I said, 'Boy, it's your choice.' Ever since then, I stopped hanging out with him, because he would go to cemeteries and hang out, smoke 10 bags of angel dust, and try to get in touch with the devil, chanting, 'Satan, Satan, Satan.' He was a drug fiend, and that's all he was." Again, Mark Fisher says, "Ricky was of the devil. When he was on acid, he'd go back into the dark woods, and he would talk to the devil. He said the devil came into the form of a tree which sprouted out of the ground and glowed. I tried to question him about it, but he said, 'I don't like to talk about it. People think I'm nuts.'" A girl known as Baker, 16 years old, said, "When the dust came to town, Ricky and the guys used to go down to the graveyard and they'd tape themselves tripping on acid and peyote and dust. They thought the devil possessed the tape, and there were all these, you know, different voices." Teenager number two says, "Ricky and this dude were in my car, and they were like, 'We're trying to get this cult going, going to the library to read up on some books. We want your mother to be the latter of it.' See, my mother has these powers. She raises tables. We've talked to Jim Morrison through a table." Mark Fisher, again, says, "If you met Ricky, he was just one of the nicest people you'd ever meet. After he smoked 7 packets of dust, we were having a regular conversation. Meanwhile, this other guy who smoked with him was in a complete psychosis, making animal movements, karate moves. The police were here, and the policeman says, 'You don't step on our toes, we don't step on yours.' Ricky would take 10 hits of peyote in a night. He would take 3, 10 minutes later he'd take another 3, and 2 hours later he'd take 4 more. He'd figured it out in his mind how to take the most without ODing. Ricky is the acid king." He talked to my girlfriend once on the phone, and she said, "Do you have a girlfriend?" And he said, "No, I'm not into relationships. They never last." That's pretty heavy. Rolling Stone calls this girl the soft-hearted girl, 14 years old. "I was the closest person to Ricky. He'd stay in the clubhouse all the time. Ricky was sweet. He needed help. I talked to him for hours and hours during the night. He didn't hate his family, but he blamed them for a lot of things. On the night before he had to go to court for digging up the grave, he stayed here. In the morning, he went home, and his father wouldn't let him take a shower or eat, wouldn't let him in the house. After court, he left him off in front of the Midway store. Ricky asked for a quarter. He wanted a bagel. But his father said no. So Ricky kicked the door of his father's red Corvette and dented it. His father left and came back half an hour later, gave him $2 and told him never to call his house, talk to his mother or sisters again. He never wanted to see Ricky again. Mark Fisher again says, when he moved back home for a while, he started scaring his parents because he wrote some songs about Satan. He'd talk about doing his drug deals openly, saying, "Mom, I'm going down to get a few hits of peyote. I'll be back for dinner." His parents got fed up with it. It wasn't just the ketchup on his wrists. He put ketchup on his wrists and called down to his mother. "See what you made me do?" His mother ran up the stairs, and he started laughing at her when she realized it was only ketchup. Rolling Stone labels this girl the Peacenik Girl, 16 years old. She says, "Ricky sang me this song that he wrote on guitar. It was something like a child of the devil. He'd put on these weird eyes and make this weird smile about it. It was cute, though, the way he did it." So that's what people had to say about Ricky. Now, this is what people had to say about Jimmy. Rolling Stone calls this girl Prepster Girl, and she said, "Jimmy, he was always kind of wild, always doing strange things. When he was 7, he took the hook on a swing set. You know how the chain hooks onto the seat? He took it into his mouth on top of the A-frame and jumped off. It gave him a big scar on his face. At the 9th grade dance, they played Monster Mash for him because he had so many scars on his face. I had a crush on him in the 5th grade. He was a nice kid." Female, former classmate, 18 years old, says, "We all knew his nickname was Drac because of his fangs. We joke about him having to go to the dentist to have his teeth filed down." Denise Walker, 15 years old, says, "I asked Jimmy what school he went to, and he's like, 'I don't need school.' I go, 'Do you work?' And he goes, 'I don't need a job.' I say, 'Well, what do you do?' He says, 'I hang out. Everything is such a quick comeback.' I said, 'Do you have any future plans?' And he goes, 'We just break the rules. People make rules, we break them.' He broke into houses, he had a good reputation as a burglar, he was at that age." Now, these are some of the things that people had to say about Gary. Mike McGroggy says, quote, "Gary was basically a good kid, young in mind. He put up a little bit of a bad front so he could hang in there with his peers." Michelle DeVoe, 15 years old, said, "Gary was like a wimp. He was more into peace than fighting. He fought to get people to like him. Why does anybody fight?" Colin Clark, 18 years old, said, "Gary'd run away from home. He'd stay in clubhouses that he knew, or in the lumberyard up the road, or in doorways." Dan Petty, 17 years old, said, "Fuzzy Legs would do things for the moment. He'd pull Midnight Auto, which is like ripping stereos off and stuff. He wouldn't think about the next day, what was going to happen to him. He'd totally fuck somebody over and not think about the consequences of it. Sometimes last summer, he stole money from his parents. He'd get $80 and go out and buy a $25 bong and spend the rest on weed and smoke it all that night. He was always like that, since he was a little kid. He was the kid that started the little forest fires, brush fires. He's the kid that climbed up the tree very high." A male teenager stated, "Gary was the type of guy that everybody liked because he wasn't selfish. I remember he got 25 hits of acid and he just gave them out. 25 hits of Sid. Gave them out." Paul Bearer number one says, "When he robbed that house, he had $4,000 in hard cash, cold cash, and he found two people, and he said, 'Hey, you guys want to go buy some motorcycles?' He bought those two kids' cycles, and one for him, and he bought a box, an outrageous tape deck, it was $300, and went to his girl's house with a gold chain for her. He was going out with her, and they'd broken up. He got there and she wouldn't go out with him again, and he was just freaking out, and he beat the shit out of the box, on the ground, right there. He didn't care. He gave one guy $500. just saying, "Have fun tonight." He went to Lace's roller rink, and he took $1,000. $1,000! And just chucked it in the air, man. Pallbearer number two says, "That's the way he was. He didn't give a flying fuck." Pallbearer number three says, "He went to Florida once. They had a little chemical bank card, and he was punching money out the whole way there and back. It was sick. One of the guys clipped the card from his father. They got thrown off the bus because they stopped at a place for the night, and in the morning they went to the liquor store and bought like mega bottles of Jack and everything, and they went to the bus and they started getting everybody on the bus really drunk. Driver pulled over and said, 'Get the fuck out.'" Girl classmate says, "In junior high, Gary was quiet and wasn't in with the cool kids. He was teased, an outsider. Gary was," I'm not going to say what she said, but it's the F word, "and she said he was an F word that got tough." Dan Petty said, "He'd be into Hendrix, Joplin, the Woodstock stuff, then rap for a while, then Sabbath. Like, I saw Gary and he had this upside down cross in his little book. It was a little brown book about Satan, and he was just saying all these stupid things, but he didn't really understand it." Terry Alto, 14 years old, says, "Holy shit, S&M Gary. Remember when that girl puked in the attic at one of those parties? Gary put on her leather jacket, the biker jacket and shit, and I was wearing one of the black leather belts with the studs. He had no shirt on. S&M Gary. He was dancing, he put on Prince. That was one of the many times Gary told me he loved me. That's when he discussed his future. He said that me and him were going to get married, and he was going to start dealing coke. And he was going to go down to Columbia, yeah, and get massive amounts of coke, and then he was going to buy me my dream apartment, a penthouse on Fifth Avenue, and the bedroom was going to be all black leather, and he was going to buy me a red Ferrari with a chauffeur. He knew it was just a dream, but it was a dream. He was a pisser sometimes, and then again, sometimes he was a dick." So now they talk about all the boys' pasts. Mark Fisher says Ricky was totally dusted out and went unconscious for a while at a party. Gary stole the dust from out of his jacket, 10 little yellow envelopes with the words "Sudden Impact" on them. When Ricky confronted him with it, he gave him back 5 and went and worked and paid him back for the rest. Gary was scared of Ricky, because every time they get together, Ricky would chew him out or beat the shit out of him. He never let him live it down, because Ricky had the money, but he didn't have the vengeance. Teenager number 2 says, "Gary was an easy target. I always saw Gary getting the shit beat out of him." Terry Alto said, "I knew he was afraid of Queso. He was scared shitless of Ricky." The Peacenik girl said, "Jimmy had just gotten out of jail. It was like April. He and Ricky were going after Gary, looking for him because he'd ripped him off. And Albert made Ricky take off his ring because he didn't want him to really fuck Gary up. I saw Ricky walking up the street looking for him, happy, psyched, and everything. And then I saw Gary come out of the room behind the white church. He walks up and his jacket was ripped. He had a cut on the side of his face, blood dripping down. Maybe his lip was bleeding. I think he hadn't paid him back the money yet." Michelle DeVoe said, "I fixed Gary's wounds up for him once, his black eye, and he had a bloody nose too. He told me Ricky was an asshole. He'd bought a knife for protection, but I don't think he carried it around. Gary told me that Ricky told him he was going to kill him. Supposedly, he said, 'Last time Ricky beat me up, he says next time he's coming back for more, and it's not going to be just a black eye.'" Colin Clark said, "There was a total spur-of-the-moment thing where Gary and some other kids decided to gang up on this guy. They were beating him up, and then Gary took out a pipe and was lighting it up, and he gave him maybe 10 bowl burns, circles with the rim of the bowl, a tattoo, sort of. Very severe. And they hurt. It was sick. It was torture. They were trying to get me to do it, because I really had an awful lot against this kid. More than anybody else. More than Gary. I said to myself, no, you'll get in trouble. Gary just had a severe dislike for him. The girl that Rolling Stone calls the Prepster girl said, Gary pulled a BB gun on two little kids up at the school to scare them. After that, he comes up to a group of my friends who are all sitting, talking, and I guess because now that he broke through his F and he's into this little dirtbag group that he's so proud of, he calls me a F. And I said, oh yeah, you're so cool, you can pull a gun on someone. And he got all mad and started chasing me and getting his girlfriends after me and saying he was going to kill me. But not kill me, just kill me. The night of Gary's murder, a bunch of kids were at a party, and some saw Gary for the last time for a few moments. Mike Lyon Minchin, 17 years old, said, everybody was fucked up that night. It was one of the first nights that school had ended, so everybody was out. It was a festive night, you could feel it. We got done with finals, people were tripping, people were stoned. Gary went into the park and came back and said, I saw cats, man. I said, sure, maybe he saw a cat in the park. And he said, no, man, there are cats all over the place. He was flipping out. One of the last things he said to me was, well, I guess it's safe for me to come down here now. I'm all paid off. I'm in good. It's safe. And then he said goodbye. He said, I'm going to get some beers and get fucked up. A lady named Dorothy said, that night, Gary said, Mom. He calls me Mom. I'm going back to school. I got my act together. I paid my debts, and I got a lot of friends, and I really care about myself, and I don't need drugs anymore. I'm going to start over. Rich Barton, 15 years old, said, I was down at the park that night. I went up to Astakia 3 hours earlier with Rick and Jim. We tried to make a fire, but we couldn't. It was wet. And then we tried to get out of the woods, but we couldn't. There was no moon, and there's a lot of paths up there. And we had the tunes cranking, Sabbath, Ozzy, Judas Priest. When we got out of the woods, I said, I'm going home, trip out by myself. The Peacenik girl said, that night, Jimmy and Albert and Ricky came up to me and wanted me to buy some peyote. They were really happy and everything. They were dehydrated, so they asked me where the nearest swimming pool was, because they wanted to go pool hopping. They asked me to go to the deli to get orange juice. I got them the biggest orange juice I could find, and they were so happy. All three of them chugged it down. They were all dosed, they were happy. The soft-hearted girl says, Ricky gave Gary hits of peyote and bought him jelly donuts at Dunkin' Donuts. First, Gary didn't want to go, but then Ricky said, we'll buy jelly donuts. So he was like, yeah. Mark Fisher says, Ricky had 25 hits of mesk in a little stash bottle down at the park. I was going to go get beers, and I gave him my box. Had my tape in it, Black Sabbath, We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll. I came back and they had left. Aw, shit. I heard they went up to Astakia, and any girls who wanted to get fucked should go up there. That was the world. So I went up to Astakia, but didn't quite make it because it was so dark. I was bumping into trees and falling down. I heard noises as I was getting closer, but I couldn't tell which way to go, so I finally gave up. According to the Rolling Stones article, Ricky and Jimmy's friends hated Albert for ratting. Gary's friends hated Albert for watching and had suspicions that he'd helped in the murder. After this interview, Albert's mother sent him out of the state to be with a priest. Albert said, Gary already paid him his money back. Everyone was his friend. I mean, Ricky and Gary were both talking a lot. Shit like that. The thing that bugs me out, man, is all of them were pushing me, especially Gary and Ricky, to take a hit of peyote. They were all tripping. It bugs me out. I didn't want to, but finally I just said, what the hell? So I took a hit. Ricky treated us to donuts at Dunkin' Donuts. To me, Gary was being cool and shit, and then we went up to Aztakia, because they wanted to go to a good tripping area, and they've got a little field where you can trip out. See, Ricky was getting pissed off, because he couldn't start a fire, so Gary just takes off his socks and puts them in there. After Gary made a fire with his socks, he didn't want to make it bigger, and Ricky comes out with a remark, "Why don't you just burn your whole jacket?" The guy's like, "How about I just cut the sleeves off and use my sleeves?" It was fucked, man, so he took his jacket and gave it to Ricky, and Gary just chopped off the sleeves. I guess he was gonna make it into a vest. All of a sudden, Gary goes, "I have funny vibes that you're gonna kill me." And Ricky was saying, "I'm not gonna kill you, are you crazy?" And shit like that. I was peeking out, tripping out, and they were just fighting, punching each other and shit. And I didn't think anything was gonna happen. I mean, I could see Ricky's point too, which is that he was friends with Gary, and he just turns around and steals 10 bags of dust? So they were just rolling on the ground and shit, and Gary got up to his feet after Jimmy had ran up to his feet, after Jimmy had run up and kicked him in the ribs and shit, and Gary had gotten up to his feet, and Ricky just bit him in the neck, bit him in the ear, and then he just stabbed him. It was a trip, man, I'll tell you, man, it was a trip. I mean, you sit there and stare out, and you look at the trees, and it looks like they're bending down and shit. I don't know, that was a trip. I thought it was a nightmare. I couldn't move, man. My whole body, all of a sudden, it just wouldn't move. It wouldn't function. It was like in shock. I was going crazy, man. I just stood there in my place, like, all bugged out. After Ricky stabbed him, Gary took off, ran, and Ricky got him, just like that. Jimmy picked up the knife after Ricky had dropped it, and he gave it back to Ricky. And Ricky made Gary get on his knees and say, "I love Satan." Then Ricky just started hacking away from him, man. He just kept stabbing him and shit. And then Gary was just screaming, "I love my mother!" It was really fucked, man. And they grabbed him by the legs and dragged him in the woods. They came running out of the woods after they just threw leaves on him and shit. They told me that he started stabbing Gary in the face and shit. I wasn't gonna rat them out, because what's, like, another body? Man, it's not a big deal. I mean, you see them kill once, you just don't think like they're not gonna kill you. When Gary disappeared, this is what some people had to say. Brian Higgins, 16 years old, said Gary had disappeared so often you wouldn't even think about it. The Peacenik girl stated, "Just offhand, I said to Ricky, 'I know you don't even care, but have you seen Gary? 'Cause we talked to his mother and she hasn't seen him in a while.' He was like, 'Nope.' Then later that night, we hung out for a while. He started complaining he was getting flashbacks. He didn't feel good. He said he was never gonna trip again. He just said, 'I just had a bad trip, a really bad trip.' He had poison ivy all over him, and I gave him calamine lotion. It freaked me out after I heard about things. I helped aid him in the cure of his poison ivy that he got by burying a friend of mine." Scott Travia, 18 years old, said, "I saw Ricky and he kept saying, 'Yeah, everything's cool between me and Gary.' Then I get this phone call from Gary's mom. She was wondering where he was. He used to sleep in my garage sometimes, in my 69 Fairlane. I said I hadn't seen him. She told me someone with this eerie voice called her and said, 'You will never see your son again because I just killed him.' Neither of us believed it." Glenn Wolf, 21 years old, said, "Gary was helping me fix my car. His tools were here, his hose was here, some of his tapes were here, and I owed him $30. It didn't connect that he didn't come back for all that stuff and ask for the money." A boy at Gary's wake said, "I was there when they threw the knife in the harbor. I saw Albert and Ricky talking, and Ricky said, 'What should I do with it?' And Albert said, 'Throw it in the water.' And then they went over and they threw it in the water. I said, 'What was that?' And Ricky said, 'Oh, nothing. It was a rock, man. I didn't think anything about it.'" Mark Fisher said, "I was walking up Main Street, just applied for a job at the ice cream parlor, and I saw Ricky making faces at a window. It was like a mirror. If you asked him what he was on, he'd just say, drugs. After that, Ricky came and slept over on the couch in my room for a bunch of nights. He'd write 666 on steam mirrors when he'd take a bath, and he'd leave at 12:30 in the afternoon before my mom came home. Jimmy spent a night too. One day I asked Ricky if I could borrow a knife. Jimmy and Ricky always carried knives in their jacket pocket, and he said, I don't carry a knife. I said, well, I don't carry one either. And he said, that's good, you'll just end up stabbing somebody. He said he was tired of living on the streets and he was going to get himself into a rehab program. One night, he came back to my house. He was on dust. He went to sleep and he woke up and thought he saw people in the room. People who had returned. He said that maybe people were haunting him. Another night, Albert and two girls held a seance at my house, a satanic ritual in which they tried to call forth the devil. It was probably the 20th or 21st of June. Ricky wasn't there. Jimmy was in the next room with his girlfriend. They started out by drawing a five-pointed star. They just traced their fingers. They put a cup in the middle. We put our cigarettes in it. What they did say was, Satan will come forth in the form of fire. And all of a sudden, the cup in the middle, after a couple of minutes, started going on fire. And they said, oh, Satan has arrived. Welcome, welcome. The Peacenik girl said, Ricky asked me if he could have a ride up to Saratoga to see the dead. I said, sure. I told him Gary might be going if we could find him. Of Ricky's death, this is what people had to say. Terry Alto says, this is the first time somebody I know died, other than people who send me checks on Christmas. It's like I still don't realize he's dead. I've dreamed about him. He's always on my mind. There's so much shit to remind me. His ID bracelet that says Gary. His little Marine's hat. Billy Leeson, pallbearer, 16 years old, stated, I'm not scared of death. You can't live life that way. If you're gonna live, I say have good times all the time. Go out, have a party, push yourself as far as you can go. If I die tomorrow, I can always say that I'll live my life to the fullest. So King Sardonic, Knights of the Black Circle, 20 years old, said, I have theories about when you die. I think it's what you think it's gonna be. For me, it's gonna be like this really classic Playboy cartoon from 1966 that had a group of people sitting around a pool. Girls and guys are drinking and there's a guy all dressed up in a tuxedo. He has the horns on and all, like a devil. And he's saying, you didn't actually think hell would be all that bad, did you? Something close to that. Michelle DeVoe said, my biggest problem in life is my friends dying. A close friend was killed at a New Year's Eve party 2 years ago. He was only 14. He called this girl a slut, and she freaked out and stabbed him. I was massively depressed. I tried killing myself. 2 weeks after that, another friend shot himself. First in the gut, and then in the heart. He was about 16. Then another friend got hit by a truck riding his motorcycle, and now Gary. My mom and dad came in. They said, we have something to tell you. First thing I thought was somebody's dead. They said, Gary's dead. I ran into my grandmother's kitchen, grabbed the biggest knife I could find, and booked it out into the backyard, and I just started hacking away at a tree, started freaking on a tree. That poor tree. One of these big oak trees. It's gonna die. I imagined him the last time I saw him, in his denim jacket, a Billy Idol t-shirt. I always called him Billy Idol because he looks just like him. He was in his jeans, his Led Zeppelin pin, and his Beatles pin. I came down to the park about 4 a.m. and sat in the gazebo and looked up where it said, Gary 666, and started crying. My parents have been watching me with a fine-tooth comb, looking at my wrist, making sure I don't come in stoned. I think, why Gary? Gary was a skinny little guy, an easy target. He went with Ricky to the woods because he was gullible. He was very insecure. He was a sweet guy and very funny. He always had a joke about something, even something that scared him. He had a lot of jokes about queso. Gary's parents were blind to the drugs, like most parents. He did them to be accepted, like most kids. I was committed to Gary. I was in love with the guy, you know? It's sick. I've seen 13-year-old girls running around with Ricky Lives on their t-shirts. They put around graffiti, Ricky Lives, dead or alive, so I'm putting around Gary Lives in our hearts. Yeah, we were lovers. That's what takes a lot out of me. I still got one of his hickeys. It won't go away. It's a scar. They had drugs a summer ago. Gary and his pals got stoned in his forest of white handprints, and they made a tape to document the event. At one point, Gary stopped the proceedings and enthused, "We contribute to this society of the man who invented acid. Fucking drugs. Man, I dedicate this tape to the man who invented Sid and Mesk. Man, this is fucking... Dude, thanks a lot, man, wherever you are. Fuck the world." A boy of 17 years old stated, "I started selling off all my possessions to get drugs. I sold my tape recorder. I was about to sell my Walkman. I sold my coin collection. That's just the way it works with drugs. At first, they're fun. Then they become necessary to get you through the day. Then they just become your total desire." Teenager number one says, "You feel like you're 10 feet tall." Teenager number two says, "You don't feel anything. You feel like you could trip your gut open and not even know it." A boy that they label the fearful boy, 17 years old, stated, "Dust is the ultimate, the end, complete hallucinations. You sit down, totally numbered out, and you start sinking into it. People can put out cigarettes on you and you don't even care. You can experience yourself sinking into a cinder block wall. It's just the suburbs. There's nothing better to do than take drugs. What else can you do? You can go shopping, go roller skating, go bowling, to the movies. There's only so much you can do before things wear out. You start taking drugs just like the people in the Bronx." Rich Barton said, "The dust high was great, but the after effects make your brain feel like a pile of shit. You can't function, can't think for shit. When you're on it, it's like you're drunk, stoned, tripping. When you fall, it feels like you're walking on water. You feel like a feather, and you feel pressure start building in your skull." Mark Fisher said, "In about a year, it will be back to normal. There'll be a different dealer, a substitute for Ricky, a substitute for Jimmy." One boy just says, "It was the dust, man. Just put it down that it was the dust. That's all." Mark Floramonte says, "We were on the Long Island Expressway the other day, stuck with a flat tire for hours, tripping on mesk. I looked out from the windshield at these clouds, white clouds, all of them in a circle, and one big one in the middle. They were like drifting and coming closer, and they were like skeleton things. They weren't like a regular skeleton. They were all distorted, but you could see the eyes, the nose, and the mouth like a regular skeleton." They had dreams 2 months after the murder. Rich Barton was still sleeping on the living room sofa, afraid to sleep in the bedroom where Ricky had crashed so many nights. His mother says, "These kids are going to need 100 years of therapy." Rich Barton said, "We were hanging out in the woods, getting wasted. I was standing closest to the grave. We had beer and weed, and all of a sudden someone pops up, grabs me, and drags me into the woods. It was Gary, and his face was all mangled and stuff. He took me into the woods, and I woke up. I just stayed up and watched Benny Hill, movies, and stuff. I had another one. I was sleeping down in my room, and all of a sudden, Gary came through my door and killed me with a knife. I was sitting there with my mouth wide open saying, 'Holy shit!' He just comes in and stabs, doesn't say nothing. I died right away." Albert Quinones says, I was trying to forget about it, man, and I couldn't. It was like every time it would hit after 12, I'd start bugging out. I'd get scared to go in my room because Ricky used to stay in there. I had some really wicked nightmares, man. I had nightmares that I killed him. It was weird. And I had a dream that I killed another guy. I just started stabbing him in the back of the head. And then a cop came in and scooped him up with a little pick or something and threw him in the garbage. It scared the hell out of me. Michelle DeVoe says, "My dream is to get the hell out of here. I want to go somewhere there are no sickos and you don't get hurt by people. I think my generation is a bunch of lowlifes. No ideals. Most of us just bumming around, getting stoned. People hate each other for stupid reasons. People have no morals. I'm going to be a peace freak. I'm more like a hippie type person than anything else. I'd like to be back in Woodstock." The soft-hearted girl said, "The first night I found out, I had a dream. A dream that Gary talked to me. I apologized to him for something. It was so real. And he said it was okay. And I said, 'Can we hang out again?' And he was like, 'There's only one problem.' And I'm like, 'What?' And he said, 'I'm dead.' I woke up with tears on my face." So, all of those people said that to Rolling Stone magazine in 1984, which of course will be linked in the show notes. I did change what the magazine actually called some of these kids because I just didn't like the way that they labeled some of them personally. But in 1991, Ricky Caso's dad completed suicide. As Medium.com reported, and I completely agree, it says, "Satan has always been an easy scapegoat. No one wants to look at the fact that Caso started doing serious drugs at such an early age, a red flag for abuse victims. No one wants to acknowledge that his seemingly normal parents kicked out their mentally ill teenage son, leaving him to sleep in the woods, the floor of his friends' houses, or whatever garage he could get into. It seems like there was a lot more going on with Caso, but since he took his own life so young, we'll never really know the whole story." And that is the case of Ricky Caso. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I also want to thank my awesome Patreons on patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Thank you so much, Lorraine, Melissa, Emily, Kara, Trevor, Liz and Shayna, Maggie, Chelsea, Brandy and Ian, Matt, James, and Shannon. Until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and I love you.
My fellow citizens, our Earth is in the middle of a crisis, plunging deeper into chaos. And though I feel your pain and your loss, we can't stand idly by and let this happen. We must rise up and... Sorry. Damn it. Well, this is awkward. Hi, my name is Josh Shell, and I am the host of the Let's Start a Cult podcast, where each episode, myself and some guests take a look at different cults from around the world. For educational purposes only, and definitely not to start our own cult. Join me every other week as we break down dangerous religious cults, political extremist groups, and every other kind of cult in between.
Should I apologize for the terrible southern accent? No?
Okay. Subscribe and listen to Let's Start a Cult anywhere you listen to podcasts.